listen till my horse tired through darts and balloons till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland.
The Rule Book and Calendar of Kittery Embers. Chapter 16. The Boy and the Crown. She saw the boy for the first time at her grandfather's funeral. He was about her age and about her height, in the leaf-toned garb the village children wore. He had black hair that hung in fangs over his forehead and small, untroubled features. His name was Archie, and he was Mr. McIntosh's son. Kittery wouldn't have known this, but Muck had pointed the boy out from the dais, where Kittery sat with a dozen members of the council. "He'll be working with me soon out in the garden, miss. If you see a boy around, that's him. That's my Archie," Muck said. The minister's body lay in a varnished box on the chapel stone. Kittery sat in silence, draped in shadowy veils of mourning. Nothing else was expected of her but a kind of spectral endurance, as though his death was also, in part, her own. As the various dignitaries rose to speak on the minister's accomplishments, Kittery watched through the tiny rabbit windows of the chapel as feathery quills of lightning struck a yellow warmth over the sea. But soon the boy caught her attention as well. He moved slower than the old people around him, as though under water. Besides herself, he was the only child in attendance, yet in the mob of severe suits and wrinkled faces, he stood apart, not just because of his youth and buttoned rags, but because he, like her, did not seem to be paying any attention at all to the service. One day, Kittery knew, Archie would take over for his father in the garden. If he was like Muck, he would be willful and self-possessed, but he would never confuse his position, neither would he fawn. The best servants, Kittery noted, had these qualities of independence and service. They thought for themselves, spoke out when they felt it necessary, and yet knew that her decisions, or her grandfather's before her, would be the final word. Mrs. Gramshaw and Muck were both like this. But the boy was also dreamy, and unlike Kittery, he studied the toneless faces of the elders around him as though there was something unusual to be found. At school, if he went, he was probably like this. No time for the dull engagement at hand. She would have to check such dreaminess in the future. She didn't want a gardener who was constantly browsing the elsewhere. However, when his navigating eyes finally settled on hers, Kittery felt something stir to life. Archie seemed to see her without temper or trapping, real or imagined, present or future. He was not admiring the girl who would soon rule over the land. He was not thinking that she was lucky or pretty or sad, nor with the insolence that such a boy might be expected to harbour, knowing that he would soon address her as my lady, and do her bidding, and keep the gardens in the way she liked, rather than the way he did. And this disturbed Kittery, for she could make no discovery from the character of his gaze, which discovery was itself the purpose of her own watching. Her grandfather had trained her in this way. The boy was not dreamy, after all, she decided. In fact, with a prickling alertness, she thought he might be what her grandfather called a direct seer. In one of his rules of power, he warned about such clear watchers. Almost everyone, the rule stated, was lost to the condition of their own dream. Such people had eyes of warped and dirty glass. These dreamers will be your staunchest allies, the rule began, for they have no interest in the world, but in the foggy enchantment of their dream or nightmare. Therefore, discover and subscribe to their inner vision, and coax it along its merry or terrible course. With even the most minor encouragement, such people can be manipulated at will. Your enemies are the lone sentries and direct seers, those with clear vision. Only they can see and will act upon the interest of the greater world, which will always be at odds with the accumulation of power. Keep the dreamers close and send the seers away. Kittery stared at Archie, willing him to look away. The more intense her silent instruction that he lower his eyes, the more closely he watched. By the end of the chapel service, it seemed to Kittery that the awful boy had stopped blinking altogether. Kittery fumed throughout the windless procession to Second Hill. As they gathered around the hole and the glittering box was lowered, she roused from her anger only when the shovel struck damp sand. She looked for Archie, but could not see him for the forest of mourners. But when the mound was patted down and the last shovel stilled, Kittery leaned to Mr. McIntosh and told him that she wanted to speak with Archie as soon as possible.
"Of course, miss," Muck whispered.
And shortly thereafter, as Kittery extended her hand and accepted the melancholy condolences of those whom she would soon rule over, the boy arrived at her side. "Behind me until the line has passed," Kittery ordered, and the boy stepped back to watch and listen as the cheerless grandees offered the girl their retrospectives and hopes for the future. When the formality was finished, Kittery turned on the boy. "Why did you stare at me like that?" she asked.
"I thought you wanted me to," Archie said.
He lowered his eyes now to signal the shift in his understanding.
"And no other reason," she said.
He continued to look at the earth, but seemed unable to formulate a satisfactory response. Kittery wanted to spin her back on him, to strike him with the denial of her good graces. He should know that his behavior was unbecoming, that he had stepped outside her favor. But before she could enact this drama, he suddenly glanced up and again held her with his mysterious indifference. She scolded him briefly with her eyes and then spoke. "Is it the business of the gardener's son to examine me in this way?" she asked.
I thought you wanted me to," he said again. "I do not. You are never to examine me again."
She stopped, not liking to admit that she could even fall prey to such a thing.
"I could banish you," she said, "in a single moment, and it would be meaningless to me."
"Not today, you couldn't," Archie said, his eyes entering their blinkless face.
"Well, after the coronation, then, I'll write it down in my book to banish you," she said.
"Then I have 4 years to change your mind," Archie said. Kittery gaped at this.
"As though you'll have the opportunity," she said.
"I'll be around all the time now, Dad says. In the house, at meals and things. He started out at 12, and I will too. I'm to learn the trade. Really, though, I think he just wants me to do the hard stuff, digging the holes. But I'm strong, and he's tired. And then, also, I have to work on my unbanishment." I may tell him I don't want you around, and that will be that, Gittery said, and pretended to further speculate on the matter. But what if you wanted me around? Archie said. Gittery would have leapt upon this, had the boy not then averted his eyes and took up a shy study of the grass. The storm had pushed in above them, like a floating electric sea. Yellow branches of tender light broke above the hills, and a thin rain wet their skin and clothes. Mrs. Gramshaw and Mr. McIntosh waited in the foggy distance to escort Gittery back. "Go ahead," she called, and the pair turned, a little sluggishly for Kittery's taste, and began to make their way down the hill. "I will never marry," Gittery said. She suspected his staring might after all be due to this common, hated premise. "Because of the rules," Archie said. She was surprised he knew. "Well, your grandfather married, and here you are on account of it. And then what will you do about heirs? Who's to take over from you?" Gittery noted with some satisfaction that he had not denied her accusation. So many of the boys in the village spied her with just this dream in their hearts. They'd wave and smile. The braver ones might approach and put in a good word for themselves. She'd already begun to keep her list of those to be banished on her 16th birthday, when the crown was finally lowered onto her head. "I would never marry you besides," Archie said. She imagined him sitting atop a rock-strewn mountain, picking tiny meat from snail shells in his banishment. "You wouldn't, then? Tell me why," she said. "I order you to tell me why someone like you would not marry someone like me if given half a chance." "Because you lie," Archie said, "and because you will only lie more, and because you know this." Confusion and outrage sped together in a flash, but her anger was unfocused. Did she lie? Did she know that she lied? "But I have 4 years to change your mind," he continued, "and I do have one thing I can offer you, something indispensable." "Indispensable," she whispered, unable to understand the word coming from the son of a gardener. "There is nothing you have that I don't," she said, but the words came out weakly and almost in the form of a question. "There is," he said, "there is one thing I'm almost certain." Gittery refused to discover his secret, and they stood, eyes pressed together in the gloomy shine of the tipping clouds and wavers of light and thunder. Finally, he gave up and leaned toward her ear and whispered it. "I can fly," he said.
Owl in the tree, that's what your endings, that's what your plans. Owl, take it from me. To sink in the forest, to sink in the sea. Rise in the morning, a disciplined day. Holly bin bin, holly bin bin, holly bin bin day. As you walk down the streets, hear the citizens say. Holly bin bin, holly bin bin, holly bin bin. Owl in the tree, like a pretty old hat in the secretive leaves. Owl, I dreamt of thee, and I followed your call, but I found only trees. Rise in the morning, a disciplined day. Holly bin bin, holly bin bin, holly bin bin day. As you walk down the streets, hear the citizens say, holly bin bin, holly bin bin, holly bin bin day.
They were in a funnel of dark air, the little girl and the old woman, rising toward the stars and the cloud of stone, Below them, cricket song bristled from the valley in streaks and strings, and for a moment, Kittery imagined it was the sound of the rain in reverse, shooting from the earth back up into the clouds. The little girl in her arms was evidently distraught and clung to her with an impairing fierceness. "There, there," the old woman said. "We'll arrive soon enough." It didn't matter what exactly was troubling the girl. Perhaps she'd lost her parents or was frightened of the height. Or it might even be gratitude and relief that she'd been discovered in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. Whatever the reason, 10 points of pain burned along the old woman's ribs as the girl's fingers dug for further safety. "Almost there now," Kittery said. The cricket song fell off in the clapping rush of wind. "A little softer, maybe," Kittery said, and resettled herself against the clinging girl. Kittery didn't want to give the girl the wrong impression. A tight embrace was perfectly fine. If the girl was this anxious or upset, it didn't feel right to modify the intensity of her touch. "That's hurting a little, dear," Kittery said. And though she reached to pry at one of the fingers to more clearly communicate the precise problem, the girl did not respond. In fact, the encroaching fingers went deeper still, and Kittery groaned with weak nausea. She wanted to see the girl's face, but it was driven tightly to her chest. "Kittery," the old woman said. The pain possessed her now, so complete that she could only fall into it, not fight it. The little girl finally looked up the expanse of the old woman's chest, her eyes shimmering with hate. As the vast grey stone of cloudy smoke spread above them, the old woman's face curled in misery and then softened as she slid into unconsciousness. And as they passed into the cool, swirling tide of the cloud, the little girl prepared for her victory. It would be just as Mumford described. She pushed her fingers deeper into the old flesh. She could already feel the laughter rising. "Something hidden, bright on thoughts and shining light. Life forgotten. There's another one here. There's another one here. There's another one here. There's another one here." Found in secret, lost. There's another one here. There's another one here. There's another one here. There's another one here. And
one here. There's another one here. There's another one here.
Through her bedroom window, Gittery watched the hopscotch of clouds gather and tumble apart. Though the sky was mostly blue, a threatening gloom was mounting over the ocean. These horizon storms had a way of racing for land, and Gittery liked the idea that it would rain throughout the afternoon coronation. It would add spice and sharpness to the dull ritual. "There," Mrs. Gramshaw said. "Have a look." Gittery spun toward the mirror and regarded the simple emerald gown. It showed well against the red of her hair and the milk of her skin, but it wasn't fancy in the way she'd hoped. Her 16-year-old girl's imagination wanted something that blazed with effect. "We'll draw silver lace across here and here and tie at the back," Mrs. Gramshaw said, appreciating Kittery's disappointment. "It is very plain," Kittery said. "To have set the diadem, my lady," Mrs. Gramshaw said, and set one large hand in a semicircle over Kittery's hair and forehead to serve as a stand-in for the royal jewelry. "The point is to be regal, not have an eye-bursting outfit. You want eyes up here, not here. You'll see when the crown drops. You will make a most stunning-looking minister. Monarch, Keepsy," Gittery reminded her. Her bare heels showed as she turned to examine the back of the dress. "I'm not sure you're permitted to alter the title of accession," Mrs. Gramshaw said. They'd talked about this before, but the girl refused to understand. "Permitted?" Gittery laughed. "It doesn't need to be official, not at first anyway. So I thought we could start here on our side." "On our side?" Mrs. Gramshaw said. "You and the rest of the staff will refer to me as the monarch following the ceremony," Gittery said. There was a knock at the door, and Mrs. Gramshaw sounded the all clear. Mr. McIntosh pushed stubbornly through the door, eyes locked to his own shoes, that he not see Kittery in any state of undress. "Will you be still taking lunch at the shack, my lady?" he asked the floor. Kittery moved to the window. Muck had pestered her with this question all week. She looked to the far corner of the field, hoping to see Archie headed for the swamp. But he wasn't there. "It's only just," Muck continued, "with the afternoon's activity, I wondered if today might be a different sort of thing. Other business cropping up, last-minute things, dresses and hair and other business." Mrs. Gramshaw looked mildly pained. "Nothing has come up," Mrs. Gramshaw said, as Kittery looked to be narrowing in on one of her increasingly frequent outbursts. Mr. McIntosh continued bravely. "Say it or depart, Muck," Kittery said. "Well, Archie," he began. "Archie wanted—" Kittery stopped him before he could go any further. "Are you here to plead on his behalf?" Kittery said. "Nothing like that, miss, no," Muck said. "Only, he wasn't sure you understand the difficulty of it. Not entirely sure. Because, you see, he's quite, and I should say, pretty altogether occupied with the arrangements. He's the painter, you see, and the only one they have. Well, the only one who can manage the fine touches. There's the ramp to be done yet, not to mention the enormous chair." "Throne," Kittery said. "Throne, miss," Muck said. Kittery said nothing further. still expecting to see the boy taking his great slow strides through the grass. I told him, of course, that I was sure you did understand, and that you required him anyway, Muck said, unable to endure her silence a moment longer. Mrs. Gramshaw and Mr. McIntosh held eyes, and a wordless sigh passed between them. Kittery stood in a small rage by the window, her cheeks pink with consternation. "He'll try to make it," Muck said. "Tell him he must make it, and there's no question about it," Kittery said. "I understand he's busy with his very fine painting, but it's my coronation, and I will not be disappointed if the very fine painting on my chair, as you call it, or the ramp I don't need, or the walls I won't see, is incomplete. Leave them unpainted. Shall I write it down and submit it to the council for a vote? It's a single hour, and I am telling him to be there. These conversations will not take place in the future, and I won't be clearer about it," Kittery said, and looked between Mrs. Gramshaw and Muck with a forgiving softness, as though admiring her own temporary leniency. "Yes, my lady," they both said together. A moment after the ruffled gardener had departed, another knock came to the door. "Enter," Mrs. Gramshaw said. Three round ladies with large leather satchels bustled in. They didn't look at Kittery or Mrs. Gramshaw. In fact, they each gave off the air of having arrived home after a long day of tedious work. They fidgeted and mumbled separately, opening their satchels, removing scissors and combs and powders and tonics, which they set down before them at the mirrored vanity. "We're not doing hair now," Kittery said, shocked at these continual revolts. "Are we not?" one of the ladies called back, unconvinced. When there was no answer, the three hairdressers turned from their kits to see Mrs. Gramshaw rushing after Kittery, who had apparently fled from the room.
"I've done the best I can here, and soon I'll make it home, dear. I tried to find my way clear. I'll try again tonight, dear. I stand upon the moonlight of a sin and catch the wailing laughter of the wind. When no one's there, you can't go home again. From once upon a time until the end."
When Kittery arrived at the shack in her emerald coronation dress, she found lunch waiting. Aside from the addition of two chairs and a tablecloth, the room was undisturbed from the way she'd found it all those years ago. Muck and Archie had offered to remove the rucksack and wheelbarrow, to fix the window and rehinge the door. It wasn't safe, Archie told her every time. But Kittery had refused every improvement, and over the years the shack had filled up with sunlight and wind from all the holes and cracks. Rain spattered the roof to the sound of soft coins, and silver chains streaked through the vents in the shingles. But the ceiling above her was solid enough, and the scooping wind could not find her where she stood before the lunch sack. Kittery removed a wax envelope filled with suet from the larger bag, which she crumbled onto the wheelbarrow stones. She chittered brightly in her imitation of the woodpecker, and then called their names. "Wizzy, Dossie, lunch." The bird dove into the cabin as though it couldn't wait another moment to be invited. He lit down on the stones and bent at once to the bits of seed and berry. At the sound of his soft pecking, Dossie, too, rooted from his hole. "Some for you, too, Dossie," Kittery said, "if you're feeling daring." The mouse's extreme sense of caution was almost always outdone by his appetite. Keeping a check on his anxiety, the little black mouse scrabbled halfway up the wall to the jutting plank of a rusty nail. He often stood on this metal splinter for endless moments, squirming on his paws, eagerly unable to leap down into the wheelbarrow. "Go on, he's got plenty to eat," Kittery urged. The mouse flared his whiskers and then made several false dashes before finally committing himself to a leap. He landed small and mild near the bird's claw, and the two regarded each other as they always did, as friendly adversaries. As Wizzy watched, Dossie very slowly reached for a nearby seed, which he spun vigorously in his paws until he found a satisfactory cornice to chew. Kittery watched the meat for a while, until she noticed the agile intruder. "Is he with you?" Kittery asked the two diners. She pointed to the little worm fingering its way through the maze of barrow stones. Both Dossie and Wizzy gave the worm a cursory examination before returning to their meal. "If he's not, then he shall be like me. He shall be unwith anyone." And Kittery thought for a moment before finishing the name off. "Mr. Unwith." Thunder struck, and the three creatures cowered, and then almost instantly puffed back to size and continued eating. Even Mr. Unwith seemed to be pursuing a bit of suet. "This place will blow into dust at any moment," a gentle voice called from behind. "That would be fitting," Kittery said before turning toward the door. She brightened upon seeing him. There were streaks of paint across his face and shirt, familiar marks where he liked to rub his hands and draw his fingers while he worked. "Managed to pull yourself away from the important ramp," Kittery said. "I didn't want to," Archie said. He shook the rainwater from his shirt and wiped his dark hair back, leaving a blue trail from the still fresh paint on his fingers. "We have a new friend," Kittery said, "a gentleman worm by the name of Mr. Unwith. Mr. Unwith, this is Archie. Archie." "Mr. Unwith, lose one, gain another," Archie said. "Not today, Archie," Kittery said. "When then? Not tomorrow, certainly, unless you change your mind." He put his hands in his pockets as a way of describing their impasse. "No one would ever find out," he pushed on. "I'd still be the gardener, the occasional fine painter. You'd be upstairs. Oh, hello, my lady. Yes, my lady, right away. And then, whenever you like, we come here. Our secret." "Our little secret is already known," Kittery said. "By who?" Archie said. "Your father," Kittery said. "He doesn't count, and keeps he doesn't count. They'll never say, and you know it," Archie said. "People know, Archie. I know they know, and I won't allow it. I see it in their eyes, the way they look at me, the way they look at you." "Let them know, then. Let it be a wild rumour. You'll still be the minister." "Monarch," Kittery said. "Monarch, then. All I suggest is, wait a while. Be the monarch for a few years. See what it feels like. I think when you realize you can't..." But he didn't finish. He didn't want to. He'd lose her right there if he said it. "What? That I can't what?" Kittery pressed. "Nothing," he said. Archie stepped toward the toppled door and pitched himself outside for a quick look. There was a ripple of brightness in the distance and dark ropes of rain hanging from the pear tree. "That I can't what?" she said again. "Nothing," he said. "You'll miss me. That's all I'm ever saying." "One goes with everyone to the square," Kittery quoted the rule. "But if one wants to reach the summit of the highest mountain, one goes alone." Archie shrugged. He despised her grandfather's rules. "Well, this then," he said, rounding on her with a new idea that wasn't new at all. We try it once. A month after the coronation, we meet here. We have lunch. That's all I ask. We're dead silent the rest of the time. No talking but for household stuff. Don't even look at each other. Kittery placed her hands on his shoulders and drew him close. And then, she began, if I say it's time to stop then, that'll be it, Archie said, without a word. Finish lunch, and I'm out the door, cross the field, into the mountains, away forever. I'll save you the trouble of an official decree. You know I would never, she said. But this wasn't true, and Archie knew it. She had a list of those to banish upon her accession, and Archie's name was at the top. Once, Kittery whispered, in 1 month, only once and only here, I'll tell your father when, but I won't change my mind. It's a joke, your name on the list, you know that. I want you to stay on, but I won't, he said coldly. Yes, my lady, no, my lady, you can imagine that. A blast of wind pounded through the forest and threw itself upon the shack, and they huddled closer. What about your mother's book? Doesn't she have something to say about this? Archie said. Why do you think we're still here? Kittery said. You can thank my mother for this. Thank you, Mrs. Embers, Archie said. But for a moment it was as though he was speaking to her, to Kittery, in the way they sometimes played at being married. He was Mr. Embers thanking Mrs. Embers for the warmth of her company. We need one more rule, Mrs. Embers, Archie called out. Something about bringing the minister's book here and your book to the house. Then Kittery can live miserably in the shack with her worm and mouse, and happily up there with me. Before Kittery could respond to this, a second, more violent blast hit the shack and drove it across the dirt. Darcy shrieked as a wild, foggy wave of dust kicked into the air. The woodpecker spread his wings. Mr. Unwith rolled into a knot. The air itself seemed to lift as the soffits burst in small flames of pulp. Archie reached for her and drew her down beneath his arms, whirling her to the floor in the rigid tuck of his body. He tumbled on top, flipped her around in one fast rip, so her face was down in the dirt. The pressure of his body drove the air from her lungs, but in the next moment he drew upward, propping over his elbows and knees to make a small, safe arbor around her. Before the roof fell, there was a series of small explosions, as though each of the supporting walls had cracked in half. And when the roof fell in its bulk and hammered down on his back, Archie cried out in a strange, small voice. Kittery watched his nearest elbow wedge deeper into the dirt like the blade of a shovel. The boy shuddered in the darkness above her, drops of cave-like sweat shooting off his straining body. And because she imagined they might be dying beneath the ton of ancient shingles, Kittery didn't know what it was that touched her lips, until he was there again, pressing his face against hers, and she understood and kissed him back.
These silly boys wrap their arms around every girl that was meant for me. Don't cross me out, I'm working for the higher-ups and the powers that be. I show you my hands on the wheel and all the photographs of famous people. Look right beside them, that's me. Oh, now come, my sweet, stroll over the moonshot land. I know, my sweet, I'm half of a moonshot man.
I'll tie your hair up in the wind. A broken waterfall, a stranded man at sea. I said I'll try to set him free. Upon the radio, without a single friend, I said I'm trying to. Shout out.